6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Karma Chavez, and Happy New Year, everyone. After my last show on December 19th, where we talked about immigration and the plight of immigrants living in the United States with Dr. Yasmin Nair, I had a long conversation with a caller who suggested that we'd only covered about two-thirds of the story. Put simply, we left out a discussion about the reasons why people migrate to the United States. So what better way to start the new year than to address that concern by drawing attention to one of those primary causes and also the source of a lot of other controversy, the North American Free Trade Agreement. 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, President Bush ceremoniously signed NAFTA along with Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and Mexican President Carlos Salinas. After being ratified by each country's legislative body, the agreement went into effect on January 1, 1994. In the 19 years almost to the day since NAFTA's implementation, lively debates have persisted about the value of this agreement, the overall benefits and drawbacks of free trade, and the devastating impacts on economies like Mexico's, not to mention the impacts on the manufacturing sector in the United States. As the Economic Policy Institute summarized in 2009, since NAFTA was signed in 1993, the rise in the U.S. trade deficit with Canada and Mexico through 2002 has caused the displacement of production that supported nearly 900,000 U.S. jobs. Most of those lost jobs were high-wage positions in manufacturing industries. That was just in the first 8 years, and that was solely about the United States. Candidate Barack Obama suggested he would renegotiate this agreement, but that has not happened. Instead, he's pushed more for free trade agreements. On the left, it's common to bash NAFTA and free trade policies. Few people seem to have specific knowledge, though, about free trade, neoliberalism, and how this impacts migration and labor. So to help us start the new year right with a little bit of education, I've invited David Bacon. David Bacon is a journalist, photographer, and cultural commentator who has written for publications such as The Nation, In These Times, and The Progressive. He regularly travels internationally to places like Mexico, the Philippines, and Iraq, and he's a former labor organizer with unions, including the United Farm Workers, the United Electrical Workers, and the International Ladies Garment Workers. His book, The Children of NAFTA, was published by the University of California Press in 2004, and a photo documentary project sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation, Communities Without Borders, was published by the ILR Cornell University Press in October of 2006. He's also the author of the 2008 book, Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Migrants, published by Beacon Press, and he'll have a new book with Beacon out this year. I followed Bacon's work for a long time. Personally, I'm very excited to have the chance for an in-depth conversation today. David, welcome to A Public Affair.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
David, if it's all right with you, I want to kind of just jump right into the meat of this conversation so that we can really take our time understanding some of the key concepts and ideas. So I'm going to start out with a broad question, which is, what is free trade and where did this idea come from?
Well, free trade is a misnomer. What free trade agreements like NAFTA do is they make it easier for, in the case of NAFTA, the U.S., to our U.S. corporations to invest in Mexico and to move production to Mexico and to, this is basically to take advantage of low wage costs and the fact that the Mexican government doesn't enforce a lot of its labor and environmental legislation very strongly, and also that to produce a flow of people who are displaced by the kinds of economic changes that are taking place in Mexico, who then come to the United States and furnish labor at very low wages for the same corporations often that are the ones moving jobs south. So it's really, it's not really about trade. What it's about is the ability of large corporations to invest, to move production, to pay low wages, and the losers in these agreements are basically working people, farmers, people on the bottom. So these are agreements that are intended to benefit the 1%, as you might say, and the people who pay the price for it, are the 99%.
So, and in terms of this whole idea, prior to NAFTA, had the United States sought or entered into other such agreements?
Well, the United States did enter into the first free trade agreement we had was with Canada. And the Canadians really had a very bitter experience with that agreement. That agreement was negotiated about and went into effect about 6 years before NAFTA did. And as a result of that, Canada actually lost jobs. Those jobs moved to the U.S., which tells you about the relative, you know, economic standing of U.S. versus Canadian workers. In other words, Canadian workers have it better. But that agreement was in some ways used as the model for what then became an agreement negotiated with the three countries together. But NAFTA is really not something that sort of exists on its own. NAFTA is an agreement that sits on top of a lot of changes that have taken place in the relationship between, especially the United States and Mexico, over many, many, many years. For instance, in the mid-1960s, Mexico began a program that was called the Border Industrialization Program, in which the Mexican government encouraged corporations from the United States to begin locating factories along the border, the famous maquiladoras. And U.S. corporations began exporting production to Mexico, essentially in order to take advantage of the low wages on the Mexican border and then take the products that were made in those factories, bring them back to the United States, and sell them to U.S. consumers. So that process of exporting production and bringing the crude produce goods back to the United States is much older than NAFTA. You know, this program began in the mid-60s. NAFTA went into effect in 1994. In fact, you know, the reason why Juarez, for instance, is a city of 2 million people now is because of that policy of locating, you know, factories there on the border and exporting the products back to the U.S. What that meant for Mexicans is that the Mexican industry was no longer producing products for the sale to Mexicans in Mexico. In other words, Mexico pretty much abandoned its own internal market, and the economic development policy of Mexico began to be oriented more and more and more towards production for export, in other words, production for the U.S. market. And what happened with Mexico and the U.S. in many ways was a model. It was kind of a laboratory for what then spread to other countries as well, too. The idea that the way developing countries or third world countries would be able to develop themselves was for producing for what was called euphemistically the world market. In other words, producing for rich countries, consumers in rich countries. And that what this meant for workers in those countries was that their governments tried to hold down the cost of labor in order to be able to attract investment, foreign investment. And we've seen what the ultimate extreme horrible result of that is with that factory fire in Bangladesh that took place a little before Christmas, where 112 people were burned to death because they were working in a sweatshop with no fire escapes and in which there was no investment at all in the safety of those workers in a country that has become notorious, Bangladesh, for having the lowest wages in the world for garment workers. And those factories are producing not for sale in Bangladesh. In fact, nobody working in that factory in Bangladesh can afford to buy any of the clothes that people are sewing on those sewing machines. This is all exclusively production for the United States. So that model of economic development wasn't exactly invented on the U.S. and Mexico border, but this is the laboratory in which it became a very, very, very large-scale model for industrial and economic development. And so this predated NAFTA. And so what NAFTA and free trade agreements do is they emphasize this. They sort of write the rules, these rules for the global economy in concrete. And that's what happened with us between, you know, the U.S. and Mexico. So the consequences for U.S. and Mexican workers, well, you pointed to one of them, which was the loss of jobs in the U.S. You know, as you said, the Economic Policy Institute documented 900,000 jobs that were lost when U.S. corporations moved production. For instance, television. We don't make any television in the United States anymore. All of that production moved south of the border. And that 900,000 is an undercount. You know, the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, was supposed to count the number of jobs that we were losing as a result of NAFTA because, as part of the agreement, U.S. workers were entitled to collect extended unemployment if they could show that they had lost their jobs because of NAFTA. And so by the time the Bush administration came along, the second Bush administration came along, we had already lost those 900,000 jobs. And the statistic was so embarrassing for the Bush administration, which was trying to negotiate an even broader agreement called the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, that it told the Department of Labor to stop counting.
Wow.
So we don't really even know how many jobs. You know, Mike Michaud, the Congress member from Maine, proposed a bill in Congress a few years ago called the Trade Act, and one of the main purposes of this bill was to hold hearings just so that we could find out how many jobs we lost in the United States as a result of that agreement. But if we think that we had it bad, Mexicans had it even worse. In the first year of the agreement, 1994, the Mexican economy lost 1 million jobs. Since 1994, when the agreement has gone into effect, when the agreement went into effect, 7 million people from Mexico have come to live here in the United States.
Wow.
11% of the population in Mexico now lives here.
Wow.
And that's a consequence of that agreement as well, too, because one of the things the agreement did was to set the conditions for declining wages, declining living standards, and the inability of people to maintain themselves as farmers in Mexico, at which point people had to do something to survive. And very often that something was to come north of the border and trying to find work here.
Sure, sure. I want to back up for a second about because what you're saying and talk about then, I mean, obviously we've seen these really devastating impacts. So what were supposed to be the positives? I mean, it couldn't have just been for big business. There had to have been other rationales, right?
Well, there were other arguments that were used to convince Congress here in the United States and to convince deputies in the Mexican Chamber of Deputies that this agreement would be positive. So we have to separate what claims were made from the agreement for the agreement with from what actually happened as a result of it. So in Mexico, for instance, one of the claims that was made for the agreement was that if U.S. companies, as a result of NAFTA, began locating more and more work in Mexico, because it would become much easier for them than to take the products of those factories back to the United States, that this would produce jobs for Mexicans, and it would produce a rising standard of living in Mexico, and the Mexican working people would benefit. So a lot of people in Mexico believe that. And the vote in the Chamber of Deputies, well, it was kind of a rigged vote, because at that time the Chamber of Deputies was still controlled by the PRI, Mexico's old ruling party, so it wasn't exactly a free debate and a free vote on it. But it's true that many people in Mexico believe that this is what would happen as a result of that trade agreement. Here in the United States, the people who defended that agreement in Congress said, well, there might be some loss of production in the United States, but because we would be able to export to Mexico, that would produce even more jobs than we would lose because of the transfer of production, so that there would be an overall net gain in the United States as a result of it, and that we could take care of the problem of the people who were being laid off and dislocated by doing things like extending their unemployment benefits, or we could negotiate side agreements onto the NAFTA agreement that would help to protect the labor rights of workers in Mexico or the environmental standards in Mexico so that U.S. corporations wouldn't be able to basically prevent people from organizing unions, for instance, or to pollute the environment. environment in Mexico in a way that they weren't able to do here in the United States. So those were the kinds of claims that were made in the process of trying to get that agreement passed. But again, we have to look at what the actual results were afterwards.
Sure, sure. If you're just joining us on A Public Affair, I'm Karma Chavis, and we're talking with journalist David Bacon about free trade, labor, and migration. I want to talk a little bit about the export economy that's created here. I just want to create a sort of comprehensive picture. So as I understand it, one of the arguments for free trade becomes this idea of comparative advantage. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about comparative advantage and then how that played out in the with Mexico with NAFTA.
Well, the idea of comparative advantage is that some countries have advantages that they need to use in order to develop their economies. So Mexico's past president, Felipe Calderon, he came to the United States at one point, and his explanation of comparative advantage was when he said that, you know, Mexico and the United States are two complementary economies. Mexico essentially has a surplus of labor, and the U.S. has a surplus of capital, and if we marry those two things together, everybody's going to do fine. Mexico's advantage in the system of comparative advantage is its lower standard of living. In other words, that Mexico can, in theory, make products for the world market at a lower labor cost than the U.S. And so thereby, therefore, by taking advantage of that, it can encourage corporations to build factories in Mexico to invest, and that the economy itself will prosper. The problem with that theory is, there are a number of problems with it. First of all, the first problem is that what it leads to is downward pressure on wages. If Mexico's comparative advantage is its low labor cost, then in order to attract investment, it has to keep that labor cost low. So what that means for working people in factories on the border, for instance, in those maquiladoras, is that when people do things that threaten to raise the price of that labor, like organizing independent unions and going on strike, or by enforcing Mexico's health and safety laws, that those are viewed as being potential obstacles to encouraging foreign investment, and the government itself steps in and basically punishes workers for those kinds of efforts. So really what it leads to is a situation in which, although workers in Mexico have very extensive labor rights on paper, those labor rights are not enforced. And now what we see is that following that same logic of comparative advantage, the Mexican government has passed recently, in the last few months, a reform of its labor laws, which is designed to take away, actually, some of the labor rights that Mexican workers have had. And some of those rights are better than the rights that U.S. workers have, at least, again, in theory, on paper. And in the interest of trying to make Mexico more competitive in the global economy, and being competitive in the global economy, again, means keeping labor costs low as a means of attracting foreign investment. So what it leads to is not just the downward pressure on wages, but it leads to a situation in which the rule of law itself is undermined. In other words, where you have laws that say things that, in fact, don't exist on the ground, where workers have the right to strike on paper, but if they go on strike, they get fired from their jobs, or even worse things happen to them. So, the comparative advantage in low labor costs can lead to some pretty drastic consequences. And to kind of like have a little historical perspective on this, what the theory of comparative advantage and producing for export, using low wages to produce for export, what these policies replaced was a previous policy in Mexico and in countries like Mexico, which sought to build up its own internal market and produce for products for the sake of sale in Mexico itself. In other words, the idea was that Mexico would have a policy of industrialization, and that the government would participate in that policy, sometimes itself by building factories or at least building the infrastructure for industrialization, that workers would be paid good wages, and then in turn, they would go and buy the products that were being produced. In other words, much more of a self-sufficient and self-contained economy. And in theory, that gave the Mexican government and Mexican society in general an interest in a rising standard of living and rising wages rather than lower wages. Now, things obviously don't work out quite as neatly in practice as, you know, as I'm explaining here. But the truth is that for many Mexican industrial workers, people working in electrical generation plants, for instance, had a union that was the pride of Latin America, one of the most democratic and militant unions in our hemisphere, the Mexican Electrical Workers Union. And people did, in fact, make very good wages in terms of the Mexican economy with very secure jobs, and had a contract at the end, which was the admiration among trade unionists all over our hemisphere here. In the interest of that theory of comparative advantage, the Mexican government 3 years ago tried to dissolve the state-run company that those workers worked for, fired 44,000 workers, declared that their union no longer existed legally, and basically set up the conditions under which the Mexican electrical system, the Mexican government hopes, will eventually be privatized, in other words, sold off to foreign investors.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory of comparative advantage here led to the destruction of a very progressive and democratic union, the firing of 44,000 people, the lowering of living standards and wages for those workers, in the interest of what? In the interest, essentially, of privatizing the electrical system and selling it to foreign corporations. That's what's called the neoliberal model.
Mm-hmm. Well, and something else, another piece of this that I wanted to ask you a little bit about then, too, was directly related to the agricultural economy. And so, of course, here in the United States, farm subsidies serve as a huge source of income for farmers. But under NAFTA and pressure from economic development organizations like the International Monetary Fund, Mexico essentially ended its farm subsidy program, right?
Yes, or it changed its foreign subsidy program so that, in effect, it subsidizes very, very large-scale producers in Mexico who produce for export rather than small farmers who are trying to stay on the land. In other words, Mexico's old subsidy system, agricultural subsidy system, and here we're talking about 30, 40 years ago, was intended to keep farmers on the land by, for instance, buying corn. In other words, Mexican government itself would buy corn from corn farmers, and corn is not only the principal crop of Mexican farmers, but corn cultivation actually probably originated in Oaxaca and Mexico thousands of years ago. The Mexican government bought corn and then turned that corn into masa and then into tortillas, which is sold in a series of state-run stores called the I've forgotten the name of the store chain, but it was basically a chain of government-operated stores in urban areas selling tortillas at subsidized prices, in other words, low prices, to poor people. So it was a subsidy program whose intention was to, on the one hand, allow Mexican farmers to survive as corn farmers by supporting prices, and secondly, to keep the price of food low as a subsidy for people, poor people in urban areas. That was replaced by what Mexico has now, which is a subsidy program that basically subsidizes very large growers who are growing, for instance, tomatoes and strawberries for the U.S., you know, U.S. supermarkets. So we have a subsidy program as well, too, here in the United States. We have a farm bill that goes through Congress every few years. The last farm bill that we had $2 billion in subsidies for U.S. grain producers. And again, these subsidies don't go up to small farmers in the United States. In fact, we hardly have any small farmers in the United States any longer. What it does is it goes to large corporations like Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland, who then use those subsidies to lower the cost of growing grain like corn, and then can take that subsidized grain, which is what they did in the wake of NAFTA, and NAFTA allowed them to do this, and to sell it on the Mexican market at a price that was much lower than on the cost of production in Mexico. In other words, Mexican farmers, especially small Mexican farmers, after NAFTA, could no longer grow corn and sell it because their subsidies were ended for small farmers. So they could no longer grow corn and sell it for the same price that U.S. producers were dumping on the Mexican market. U.S. producers were selling corn in Mexico at very, very low prices during that period, essentially in order to drive Mexican producers out of the marketplace, which it did. Mm-hmm. And Mexican corn production is now very monopolized, and Mexican tortilla production all belongs to one corporation called Grupo Maseca. So the consequences for Mexican farmers were disastrous. When people in Oaxaca, southern Mexico, could no longer make a living in small villages by growing corn, people had to do something to survive. And very often, again, what that something was to leave home and look for work elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Mexico, northern Mexico, as farm workers on those same farms that were producing for export to the United States or crossing the border and becoming the workforce in the field for California or Arizona or Illinois or North Carolina.
If you're just joining us on A Public Affair, I'm Karma Chavez, and we're talking with journalist David Bacon about free trade, labor, and migration. I want to actually pick up on this point, talking about Oaxaca, which is something you talk about in your book, Illegal People. You write, quote, about 30 million Mexicans survive on less than 30 pesos a day, not quite $3. The minimum wage is 45. The federal government estimates that 37.7% of Mexico's 106 million citizens, 40 million people, live in poverty, and 25 million, or 23.6%, in extreme poverty. In rural Mexico, over 10 million people have a daily income of less than 12 pesos, a little over a dollar per day. You then go on to talk about the state of Oaxaca, the second poorest state, and the state with the second highest concentration of indigenous residents. And this state is also the site of the 2006 teachers' strike and other unrest. So could you talk a little bit about Oaxaca as a case study and how it relates to the conversation we've been having so far?
Sure. Well, we already talked a little bit about the economic pressure on small farmers in Oaxaca that was caused by NAFTA and by corn dumping. In other words, in small villages, Oaxaca is a state in southern Mexico in which a big majority of its people live in small towns and basically make their living from farming. It's not an industrial state, it's an agricultural state. And Oaxaca is also a state that has more ethnic diversity than any other state in Mexico. People in Oaxaca speak 23 different languages, which are all older than Spanish, at least Spanish in Mexico. In other words, people were speaking languages like Mixteco or Zapoteco for 1,000 years before Columbus ever arrived in the Americas. So this is what Oaxaca kind of looks like demographically. And so when NAFTA came along and the price of corn dropped and the subsidies for farmers, small farmers, ended, this resulted in an enormous amount of pressure on people in those small villages. People, in other words, had to do something to survive. And what it did was it made people leave. It displaced people. Now if you go to many small towns in the countryside in Oaxaca, you find towns where almost everybody living there is either very, very old or very, very young, because the working age population has had to leave in order to find work, in order to survive. So it's created a kind of an expulsion of people from Oaxaca, an economically based one. Now you can imagine that this is something that gets people pretty upset and pretty angry. In other words, the fact that they're is no longer an alternative to migration, that people have to leave to survive. Plus, Mexico is still, you know, only 100 years away from the Mexican Revolution that raised people's idealism about Mexico the idea that Mexico was going to be a country in which ordinary people, farmers and workers, would have a voice, in which people would have some power, in which the country was supposed to be run for their benefit. And instead what you have is, you know, corn dumping and expulsion and displacement. So people get very, very angry about it. In 2006, what happened was that teachers in Oaxaca, who are a pretty radical bunch of people to begin with, went out on strike, basically trying to get their wages up, and not only their wages up, but to get more support for the school system in Oaxaca, which was basically going broke. I mean, in Oaxaca, teachers have to come up with a lot of the supplies for their own students and paying for them out of their own pocket. You know, that's not actually unusual for teachers around the world. Even in the United States, teachers do that. But in Oaxaca, the situation of the poverty of the students in classrooms was such that teachers themselves had to, basically produce the supplies that students needed to be able to learn. So when those teachers went out on strike, people were already so angry about the economic direction for Mexico and the state of Oaxaca itself that strike became kind of like a popular uprising, an insurrection. People were out in the streets demonstrating for weeks and for months, actually, and Mexico finally, the federal government in Mexico and a very repressive state government in Oaxaca finally brought in troops and the police and put the uprising down, but many people were killed and people went to prison as a result of it. And people fled Oaxaca also. A lot of people had arrest warrants out for them and had to come to the United States basically in order to avoid being arrested and sent to jail in Mexico. And for what? Because they were protesting about the fact that there were so few alternatives, especially for young people in Oaxaca, other than leaving home and becoming a farm worker in northern Mexico or in the United States. So, this is basically what happened to people in Oaxaca as a result of, this kind of model of economic development of which NAFTA is a part. But I think it's also, people in Oaxaca are very creative. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important political movements in Oaxaca, especially since 2006, has been the movement for what people call el derecho de no migrar, or the right not to migrate, mm-hmm. or the right to stay home, I guess you could say. And basically what this is about is people are saying, well, we need to have some kind of economic development in Oaxaca that makes migration into something that's voluntary rather than something that's forced. On the one hand, there's so many people from Oaxaca who are now working as migrants in other parts of the world, especially here in the United States, that one of the main concerns of communities in Oaxaca is protecting the rights of migrants. And there are organizations that exist among Oaxacans here in the United States that do a very good job of fighting for people's rights to translation and court system, or fighting for immigration legalization, or fighting for the rights of migrants generally. But people also in Oaxaca are saying that that's good, but we also need to make it possible for young people who are growing up in Oaxaca to stay home. Mm-hmm. There has to be some future for people in Oaxaca other than leaving.
Sure.
So that people can actually make a choice about it.
Yeah.
I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Actually, Dave, we have a caller now. Caller, if you could state your first name and your question.
Hi, this is Phyllis. And thank you so much for having David Bacon on. This is so informative. And David, we worked together in the United Farm Workers in 1977.
Oh, hi, Phyllis. I remember
hi.
You.
back then you were called David Tocino.
Right. Sure was. And that's because Tocino means bacon in Spanish.
Right.
Exactly. So my question is, could you please tell us what we can do as consumers and as political activists to fight free trade and its effects?
Well, first, I think that we have to be politically active, especially this coming year. And we have to look at our immigration system and our immigration laws and change our immigration laws. So on the one hand, people who are here as migrants can have legal status and some ability to organize and fight for their own interests as migrants, meaning that we need some legalization here, as well as other changes in the immigration system so that people can reunite their families, end the guest worker programs that sort of treat people as beasts of burden and basically contract people to come to the United States to work and then throw them out when the work is done, and also end the system of deportation that resulted in the deportation of 400,000 people a year over the last years of the Obama administration. So these kinds of things need to be changed. And changing our trade policy is obviously part of changing our immigration laws as well, too, because we need not only to help people gain rights and equality here in the United States, but as people in Oaxaca are saying, we need to make it possible for people to stay home, too, if they want to stay home. And that means that we have to end those trade agreements that are putting such strong economic pressure on people to leave home. So that means that we need to be here politically active this year and to take a look at what's being proposed in Congress and advocate for those kinds of reforms that are going to basically strengthen people's human rights and labor rights and avoid those kinds of reforms that actually make our situation here worse. So one thing is political activity. But I think also we need, as consumers, to take a look at what we can do to put pressure on the system to increase the standard of living of workers, whether they're migrants here in the United States, people working in the fields in Mexico itself, or, people basically working at jobs here regardless of what their, migration status is or where people are coming from. And what I'm thinking of, for instance, are things like the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida has been able to negotiate agreements with McDonald's and Taco Bell and some of the fast food franchises as well as supermarkets in which they forced them to pay more money to tomato growers in Florida with the proviso that that money then gets used to increase the wages for people working in the fields. And they appealed for the support much the way the United Farm Workers did to us in the days when we were working for the union, appealed to the support of consumers, asking consumers essentially to put pressure on these large multinational corporations to basically pass more money down the chain so that it arrives in the pockets of people who are actually doing the work. And I think that that applies to not just farm workers and people from Mexico, but I keep thinking about the women who died in that factory in Bangladesh in that terrible fire, and the fact that the clothes that they were sewing at those sewing machines in that factory were all going for Walmart and for U.S. producers here. So we need to use our power as consumers to basically force those corporations to not just to pay more. Obviously, they have to pay more so that people can have a decent standard of living and also to fix the terrible lack of safety conditions that resulted in the death of those women in the fire. But what's, I think, even more important is to force those corporations to respect the right of people to organize.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's organizing unions among women who work in that garment factory or organizing unions for people who work in the fields here in the United States, or organizing as people are doing it in their home communities in Oaxaca, because really my experience with the United Farm Workers Union is that when the energy comes from people themselves, in other words, when people themselves get organized and make demands, then we can support those demands as consumers. I don't think that we can take the place of what people do themselves, but we can sometimes buy people some space to organize by putting pressure as consumers on companies like Walmart or Nike. Students Against Sweatshops did a pretty admirable job, I think, of putting pressure on Nike Corporation to ensure that Nike then required its contractors in Mexico and Central America to recognize the unions that workers were organizing in the factories where their clothes were being produced. Mm-hmm. So I think those are at least some ideas about what we can do.
No, that's great. Thanks for the call, Phyllis. And actually, we have a couple other callers, I think, on the line, David. So next caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Methuselah. And my question for the speaker is one that's often puzzled me. And that's, why is there so little emphasis placed on the changes that need to take place within Mexico itself? I always seem to detect this attitude that there's an immutable law, that Mexico will always be a poor country, and that nothing can be done about that. And that attitude I find even among most Mexicans I speak with. Very few of the ones that I speak with seem to understand or think that any kind of change, political or economic change, is feasible within Mexico. Most don't even consider that topic. It's just something that I assume that they've just given up on expecting any change from within the Mexican political system. And that's something that I find very frustrating, because I think that a lot of the change needs to take place down there. I mean, certainly legislation like NAFTA is to blame for a good part of the problems, but there's also the corruption and dishonesty and violence, which seems so inherent in the Mexican political establishment. So I was wondering if you could make any comments about what I feel is a very crucial point that doesn't get much discussion. And thanks for an interesting program.
Thanks. David, what do you have to say in response to that?
Well, I think that in my experience, there's a great deal of political turmoil that goes on in Mexico. I tried to point to some of it, you know, like the fight of the electrical workers for their jobs in Mexico, which was probably the biggest labor fight in Mexico over the past few years, or what people are doing in Oaxaca calling for the right to not migrate. They actually were able to throw out the PRI government in Oaxaca, the one that put down that uprising in 2006. And elected a much more progressive government that is now trying to find ways of, you know, encouraging that kind of economic development that will give people some choices in terms of migrating. So I don't really think that Mexico lacks for social movements trying to force political change. Mexico has a political system that has been very repressive in the past. About, so, you know, organizing for political change in Mexico is sometimes very difficult, and also the costs of being part of the opposition in Mexico are sometimes higher than they are here. In other words, people suffer not just the loss of their jobs, but, you know, some pretty terrible things can happen to people and have happened to people in the past. And one of the big movements in Mexico, for instance, is to try to get a truth commission that will talk about, you know, earlier efforts during the 1960s, where, you know, for instance, hundreds of students were massacred in Tlatelolco Plaza in the year of the Olympics, as they were calling for political change. And now one of the big efforts in Mexico is to get some truth about what actually happened during those years. So I think that Mexico has a lot of movements that are calling for political change. And one of the most important things that we can do here in the United States is to learn about those movements and then figure out, as Phyllis is talking about, what we can do to support those movements. But in terms of the inherent corruption of the Mexican system, I think that the corruption in Mexico comes because of the domination of the Mexican economy by a very wealthy elite who use that economy for their own benefit. And I would say that in this country, in the United States, we suffer from exactly the same kind of corruption as the Mexican government does. After all, remember, if you want to accuse the Mexican government of taking bribes, well, let's look at that recent series in the New York Times that talked about Walmart in Mexico paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in Mexico in order to get, first of all, take over a Mexican retail market chain, and in order to get permits to build a new Walmart right next to the Pyramid of the Sun, Teotihuacan, right outside of Mexico City. So corruption. Revolution, as they say, it takes two to tango, you know. Sure, the Mexican government officials shouldn't have taken that money in order for Walmart to build its store. And there was a lot of opposition, a great deal of opposition to the building of that store. So I don't think you can say that it happened without a popular movement against it. But it also took Walmart, you know, a U.S. company with money in hand, you know, coming along and bribing those officials. You know, this is really not a problem of the inherent corruption of Mexicans, because I don't think that any people are inherently corrupt. I think the problem is this is the 1%, 99% problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have the same problem here in the United States. We have an economy that's dominated by a very tiny handful of extremely wealthy hedge fund investors and banks. And the Mexican economy has that same kind of domination. And just as we are fighting for a change in the political system here, people in Mexico are fighting for the same kind of change. So the logic is, should be, I think, we should support each other because, after all, we're really for the same thing.
Sure. Great. Thanks a lot for that answer. Thanks for the call. I think we do have another caller on the line. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Hi, Karma. This is Sarah Roberts calling.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, this is a great show and a critically important topic, so I really appreciate all the information that your guest is providing. I guess my question relates to how Mexican migrants are viewed within the context of the United States. And based on the case that your guest has made, it's clear that the migration process of Mexican people into the U.S. is a fundamental mechanism in terms of the neoliberal arrangements like the NAFTA agreement that we're talking about. Given that, what is the continued What stands to gain by continually demonizing these migrant people who come here basically by design politically and economically within the United States? What is the nature of that when, in fact, this is actually the system functioning as designed?
Thank you. Great. Thanks, Sarah. David, could you take that question?
Yeah, I think that the question itself poses some very deep, deep questions and basically has a pretty good analysis of what the situation is here. In other words, the reason why people are being displaced in Mexico is not because something is broken. It's because the economy is working very well for the benefit of the people that run it. So I wrote an article for The Nation magazine that appeared a year ago in which we took, as an example, Smithfield Foods, the largest pork processor and slaughterhouse in the world. And this is a company that, on the one hand, broke unions in it when people were trying to organize in Tar Heel, North Carolina, and also relocated production to Mexico, creating an environmentally disastrous series of pig farms in the valley in Veracruz, which is where the swine flu started a few years ago, and also dumped pork on the Mexican market, basically leading to the same kinds of effects on Mexican farmers that corn dumping had.
Mm-hmm.
So Smithfield Foods used this kind of neoliberal economic model in order to basically make money, whether they were making money by dumping pork in the economy in Mexico or by keeping wages low in its plants here in the United States. So this is, you know, this is who is gaining by the system the way it operates today. And so for them, it's not a broken system at all. But in order to defend it publicly in Congress, it's hard for Smithfield to go to Congress and say, well, we like the current system because it keeps wages low and it keeps people flowing into our plants here and it enables us to, you know, dump our meat on the Mexican market and everything is hunky-dory here. So what we get instead are, you know, it's kind of, I guess you would say, a smokescreen. It's used to hide what the actual sources of the problem are and who's benefiting from it. So one of the ways in which the smokescreen operates is in the demonization of people. So instead of looking at the people, for instance, who are being displaced in Mexico by corn dumping or pork dumping or environmental contamination or the breaking of their unions, as being people who are displaced and ordinary working people just simply looking for a way to survive, we get instead a kind of a propaganda campaign that says, well, these are people who are trying to game the system. It's mm-hmm. women who are seeking to have babies in the United States, you know, the anchor babies so that they can get green cards and become citizens. It's people who are trying to collect welfare in the United States because they can't collect it in Mexico, or people who are stealing our jobs here. And basically the net intent, I think, of these kinds of smoke screens or demonization campaigns is to divide us as working people, so that instead of looking across the divisions of nationality and seeing another person, a working person like ourselves, we kind of see these stereotypes that are being used as a smokescreen to hide who's actually winning in this kind of system. So I think that's where a lot of the racism and the demonization comes from. Essentially, it's coming from people who are benefiting from the system. And if we want to put, you know, names on it, it's coming from people like, for instance, Kris Kobach, who is a Tea Party architect, you know, Secretary of State for Kansas, who then went to Arizona and wrote Arizona's infamous, you know, 1070 law, and then went to other states throughout the South trying to write these same kinds of laws that would lead to racial profiling and the demonization of migrants. And, you know, what does he get out of it? He gets out of it a political career, you know, with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which becomes part of the, that sort of constellation of political organizations that formed the right wing of the Republican Party and that basically tried to dominate the last election. And, you know, it's really the same group of people who are in Michigan, you know, passing Michigan's right to work law to break unions in Michigan, or who are doing the same, passing the same kinds of laws in Indiana, or trying to in Ohio, although in Ohio they were defeated, or who are in Wisconsin basically threatening to withdraw the ability, or not threatening to, but actually did, withdraw the ability of public employees to organize unions, and who then basically turn around and say, well, the economic problems of the United States are as a result of people stealing our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the smokescreen basically is used to divide people and to hide a political and economic agenda that benefits a very tiny elite of people here.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, we only have about 1 minute left here on the show, but I wanted to ask you, I know you have another book coming out from Beacon Press this year. I wonder if you could just tell us briefly what that book is about.
Well, it's actually called The Right to Stay Home. It's about what's happening in Oaxaca and people talking about what the alternatives are to forced migration. And it also tells the story of the Smithfields and the workers in the meatpacking plant in Tar Heel and those farms in the Paropa Valley where the swine flu started. So it's on the one hand describing how the neoliberal economy operates in terms of displacing people and then criminalizing people who get displaced. But it's also talking about what the movements are of people who are trying to change those political priorities, whether in Oaxaca they're fighting for the right not to migrate, or organizing unions among farm workers, or among people in that meatpacking plant in Tar Heel. So it's basically about that.
Great. David, I just want to thank you so much for being a part of our show today.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've been listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Karma Chavez. Our guest was David Bacon, a journalist, photographer, and author. His most recent book is called Illegal People, and his new one is going to be called The Right to Stay Home from Beacon Press. You can find links to his articles as well as his photographs at dbacon.igc.org. And you can find him in The Progressive and The Nation and many other outlets a lot. Thanks again for listening, and have a wonderful New Year's, second day after New Year's Day.